help me welcome our speaker tonight is Rini from Fishtown.
Hi, I'm Rini. I'm an alcoholic. My hope always when I speak is that God comes through and speaks through me and that ego is left aside. And I do pray that even just one person that is here is helped, even if it's not today, but maybe a seed will be planted and it could help down the line somewhere. I think that's our purpose, is to do our best to help the next alcoholic. And my heart is like pounding out of my chest right now. I guess I'll just start from what it was like. I grew up in, came from Philly. By the way, there's a second basket being passed around for gas money. That wasn't funny. I grew up in a neighborhood, Kensington. Some of you might know it. And I grew up in a house with two loving parents, three brothers. There was no lack of love, no like craziness happening in the house. My parents did the best that they could with what they had. And I think that's, you know, everybody in the world, you know, no matter what their journey looks like, no matter what their lives look like, I really do believe that everybody is doing the absolute best that they can with the tools that they have. Someone else's best might not be my best. And my best one day might look different than my best the next day. I'm just, you know, I think we're all just here learning and growing and experiencing life the best that we can. And I remember from a really young age, probably as far back as kindergarten, just never being okay with myself. Like, I always thought that there was some kind of outside thing that was going to make me feel better. That social status or financial status, you know, what my house looked like, what kind of car my parents drove, what my clothes were, like all those things were going to make me feel okay. And my parents had four kids. Like it was a little tough to keep up with our clothes and everything. I have one son and you know, I can't even imagine having four. And I know that, again, they did the best that they could. Just to kind of set the tone for the way that things kind of operated as far as feeling, and expressing your feelings and all that stuff growing up. My mom was 16 years old and she was doing the dishes on her house. I grew up on Lehigh Ave, down by the river. She grew up maybe 7 blocks from that, like towards Kensington Ave. And she was in her house doing the dishes, 16 years old. One of my uncle's friends ran in the house and said, "Larry just got hit by a car." And they were freaking out. My mom ran out of the house with no shoes on, ran down to Aramingo and Lehigh, and she saw my uncle laying in the middle of the street. And he was hit and killed by a drunk driver. And after that, there was 6 of them. And you know, so it was my mom, my pop, and then the 6 kids, and then Larry died, and they were never to speak his name again. They took his picture off the wall, and they weren't allowed to talk about him anymore, because it made my pop upset. And that's kind of the way that they were taught. You know, that was just my mom's side. My dad's side, same thing, except they covered it up with a lot of humor. Like a lot of, you know, any kind of pain, it was masked with humor. But that was just kind of the gist of how feelings were processed for them growing up. And it was kind of passed down to us. And I think the blessing in AA is that these generational habits and curses, in a sense, are being broken because of the 12 steps and because of our relationships with God. And not, you know, passing that down to my son. I have a brother in AA, like, who's learned a different way of life in here too. And to not give that to our kids too. Like I said, my mom was one of 6 growing up. My uncle got hit and killed. And then I had an uncle when I was in the sixth grade, took his life. And then I had an aunt in 2013 who took her own life. And it was a lot of like alcoholism, depression, you know. I got to a place, like I think when I was younger, I didn't really get it. When I was in the sixth grade, it's like, how could they do this? How could they do this? And I could say firsthand, I got to a place where I was 6 months sober and wanted to kill myself. And I really understood why they did what they did, because it really feels like there's no other option left. And I'll get to that point. Again, like kindergarten, just always wanting anything else. Like as I'm growing up, thinking the perfect boyfriend's going to fix me. The perfect family's going to fix me. I always thought other people's families were cooler than mine. Other people had a better car than our family did. We had the Griswold Mobile with the, you know, it was like the wagon with the wooden panel on the side. And, you know, my dad would go to drop us off at school. We would have him drop us off a block away so nobody saw us get out of the car. And that's what it was. It was like shame and embarrassment of stuff that I should have been grateful for at the end of the day. And I always felt less than. My ego, like, separates me to never feel equal to anybody. And depending on if you are prettier than me, if you have more money than me, if you have a better career, or, you know, the list can go on. Like, I always felt less than because of these outside things. And then, you know, on the other hand, I, you know, before I understood alcoholism even, before, you know, I learned a lot in life from my own experiences, I would judge you and feel better than if I, you know, you were poor or you were begging for change outside of Wawa, or, you know, I never felt equal. And that's kind of how my life went. And I had friends that started doing, you know, we started drinking probably seventh grade. We would drink at the playground. And then, you know, then it would be house parties for the cool parents would let us go and drink in the houses. And, you know, and then eventually we're getting into the bars. But it was always just like a weekend thing. It was never anything more. Like we drank on Friday, we drank on Saturday, and then the planning for the following Friday started happening on Sunday. And that's all I could think about the whole week through school. Like I was not eating lunch and saving my lunch money in order to do the alcohol that I wanted to do on the weekend in high school. And, you know, I had friends that drank exactly like me. They did the same exact things that I was doing. I think the difference was that they didn't obsess in between the times that they drank, you know, the last time to the next time. Cause it's all I thought about. What are we going to drink? Who's going to be there? You know, how's the scene going to go? It was, you know, first it starts out, there's four of us on a case of Bud Ponies or Zima or St. Ives Special Brew, whatever, you know, we were drinking on that weekend. And then it was like less people on a case as time went on. And I remember just putting myself in situations that I look at now, you know, in eighth grade, freshman in high school, knocking on strangers' doors that we knew he was alcoholic. You know, the guys that we would knock on their doors were alcoholic. We would pay them to get us alcohol up the street at the beer distributor. And I'm jumping in these guys' cars and, you know, just putting myself in situations from a very young age that I shouldn't have been in. And I remember, like, some of my friends started taking it to the next level and doing harder stuff than the rest of us. We were all doing stuff, but they were doing the hard stuff already. And I just remember saying, like, that's never going to be me. I'm never going to be them. They had it rough growing up. You know, this happened to them, or, you know, whatever circumstance I could give for the excuse of why they were the way that they were. And I got through high school again, like weekend drinking, drank through the summer, weekend drinking, and that's how my high school went. And I had, I got to college. I didn't go to college for, you know, like the right reasons. It was more for the party scene, play soccer. I forged my advisor's signature pretty much my whole entire college career, to do easy classes that I still couldn't even show up for. And then sophomore year, I was playing soccer. I tore my ACL, and I had to get a surgery to repair my knee. And after that, I had become exactly what I swore I'd never be. And, you know, the lying and the manipulating and the stealing and the running, you know, my family through the mud, you know, stealing from my mom, watching her cry, wondering, like, which one of her kids is taking from her purse again, and just being able to, like, just hope that that she didn't pinpoint me. You know, always, like, pushing the blame on my brother. You know, I from the time I was a sophomore in college, for 7.5 years, I couldn't draw a sober breath. And, you know, I had tried. Like, there was times, like, I had tried, and, I just couldn't get it together. Like, I couldn't get one day. And I wound up failing out of college. I was there for 5 years, and somehow I failed out after 5 years. Usually people are done by then. And, I moved back home to my mom's, and she was like, you can't just hang around here and do nothing. You have to get a job. I knew I couldn't get a job, like a decent one without passing a test that I knew I couldn't pass. So I would just, finally she was getting so sick of me. So I pretended that I had an interview. I had her, take me to the mall and buy me, like a business suit skirt thing and a jacket. And I got dressed up. I had her drop me off at the L. I took the L down to Center City and walked around for like 3 hours with like a little briefcase, with my resume in it, and just pretended to be on a job interview. And the lies that I would tell, like just something so simple as that to, you know, like that was normal at the time. Like pretending to answer the phone, like a phone call was coming in when I was at family dinner because I just couldn't sit there for another 5 minutes. So I would fake a phone call to get out of it and pretend I was on the phone with somebody and they needed me right away. So I had to leave because it was an emergency. And, it was just like constant. And then worrying about who I lied to, if they were going to talk to someone else that I told a different lie to and then get caught up. And it was just constant like chaos and disorder in my mind and in my life. And I finally get a job as a bartender because I couldn't get a job, doing anything else. And I'm bartending again, like I'm not sober. And I wind up, you know, my Prince Charming walks in with my kind of alcohol that I like. And I wind up connecting with him, and I was pregnant 3 months later with my son. And no human power can relieve my alcoholism. I couldn't get a day. I swore up and down every single day, tomorrow's the day. I'm going to stop tomorrow. And I couldn't. I believed with my whole heart that I was going to, like, this was going to be the last day. And I woke up and I didn't have the choice anymore. I hadn't had it in a long time, but I remember, you know, judging other women that I would see, like, smoking a cigarette pregnant. And there I was. I couldn't get a day sober through my entire pregnancy. And I moved up to the Northeast with his biological dad. And, you know, I didn't want to – I moved up there because I was far enough away from my family to where – they're not going to be really popping in or anything, and I'm able to pretend that I'm in this great relationship and it's happy and healthy and all is going good, and I could just lie on the phone. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was a complete nightmare. And, you know, every kind of abuse you can imagine. And I felt so alone. Like, I was, you know, going to ultrasounds, pretending that he was with me and I was by myself. Like, I went through my whole entire pregnancy by myself. And my mom would have came. She would have showed up for me. I just wanted to, like, keep this facade that, like, you know, this was a great thing that was happening for me. And so I had my son, and I think, like, at that point, like, it got 10 times worse than it already was, because I was now taking care of a new baby by myself for the most part. Every time I would try to crash, he would wake up, or he would cry, or he needed to be fed. So then I had to do more of something to keep me awake. And then I'm awake 3 days in a row, at a time, losing my mind, seeing things that aren't there, and, just like complete, like, alcohol induced psychosis with a newborn. And I really think, like, if I hadn't, like, something didn't intervene at that time, like, I would have completely lost my mind. And my friends came, they got me out of there. I stayed at my one friend's house for a couple of days. I still, you know, was not sober. But they were taking care of my son so I could sleep it off for a little bit. And then I wound up going back to my mom's, and I was living on the third floor at her house with my son. And something happened, and then I wound up in the hospital and came to. And my mom was at the foot of the bed, and she just, you know, looked distraught. My brothers had, like, ransacked my room and found a bunch of stuff in there. And so there was no, like, talking it out. Like, I, you know, she would give me, you know, tests that I would, you know, somehow finagle to go the way that I wanted them to go. And I was found out at this point. And she said, if you don't go get help now, we're adopting Benny out. And, you know, I know that, like, before I really had a 12-step experience, I would think, like, oh, well, that was my choice. Like, I decided, like, I was given an ultimatum. I was painted in a corner, and I decided that, you know, I'm going to go away, and because I wanted to keep my son. And the reality is, like, God had to be in there somewhere, because people lose their kids every single day to this. And I could have easily just said, take him, because he's in the way. And that was the truth of it. And I decided to go to rehab. I was waiting on a bed. I had BHSI, had no health insurance, so I had to go through the county-funded health insurance. And I was waiting on a bed, and I have my brother who's in AA. So it's my first resentment with you guys has come directly from him. And he was like, call me, and he said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. And I was like, fine, I'll go, but I'm not going anywhere where anybody knows me. I'll go somewhere where no one knows me. And so he took me down to South Philly Group on Moy Mensing Avenue. And I walk in, and I see, like, there's this, like, setup, and there's two people up front, and I look, I'm just thinking, like, oh, my God, he brought me when the president and the vice president are here. And I had no idea. Like, I had no idea that they were just two people up there in service and one speaking, just trying to get another day and spread the message. And I sit against the wall, and at this point, I'm in a 7.5 year, like, day one of withdrawal. And so I'm, like, just shaking and sweating and trying to listen, and I just keep hearing people talk about a book, and I'm just thinking, how big is this book? And I'm just picturing this book that's, like, you know, way too big. And I did notice that there was, like, people that I had this, like, judgment or this, like, thought of what AA was, and there was people in the rooms that I looked, and I'm like, they look just like me. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And so I go away to rehab. I go to Keystone in Chester, and I stayed there for 28 days. I think I didn't sleep until maybe day 22. And I was listening to people, and they were talking about, you know, working the steps and getting a sponsor and going to meetings, getting a home group, doing a 90-90, giving all these suggestions that help. And I, you know, nothing really sank in. And, I was talking to a tech outside, and he said, if you get this now, your son never has to know you load it. And I thought that I was going to run with that. Like, that's the thing that's going to keep me sober. And, so I left there. I started going to South Philly Group. I wasn't doing the work. I was making meetings. I fake went through the steps, I guess you could say. Someone, you know, took me through a different kind of, not through the big book. And it was really just to say, yeah, I went through the steps. Did you? Because I feel like that was the one question everybody asked at the meetings. If I, you know, did you start going through the steps yet? And I just wanted to be a part of, because I never felt a part of my whole life. Like I always felt like I was separate, different, not a part of. And I just, you know, pretended to do things that I was supposed to be doing. And so, like I said, like I thought I was going to be able to use my son to keep me sober. And again, like once again, no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And if it was as simple as kids keep us sober, or a mother's love, or, you know, a family member's love keeps us sober, like I don't think we would even need AA. But that's not how it works. And I picked up after 90 days. And I remember there was a woman that came down to speak at South Philly Group. And I was so excited because I didn't know anybody. Like, I mean, I wound up meeting people, but I didn't know anybody there because I was hiding. And so I went there the one day, and this woman was speaking, and I was like, oh my God, I know her. This is awesome. I finally know someone. And so she went to the front to start speaking, and she started talking about God. And I'm like, oh God, they got her too. And, I stopped listening to what she was saying. Like my ears completely closed. And I don't even know what she said. But I do know that there was a time that I became so desperate and broken that it was her light that I remembered. And I remember she was smiling. I remember she looked happy. And it was at a point where I was dying on the inside. I had picked up, not my alcohol choice. But then I was like picking up and putting down and picking up and putting down. And then comparing myself to everybody in the room, and I'm saying I'm definitely not alcoholic if I could pick it up and put it down, and this person can, and, you know, this person's life falls apart in 72 hours, and I'm not like you guys. And I'm still going to meetings because I feel, like, disconnected at home. Like, I already have that stigma on me because of my brother in AA and him trying to drink and never being successful. So then I had that on my back, and I just felt like I couldn't like feel a part of anywhere. And I stopped drinking. I took my last drink August 28th, 2015. And by the time February rolled around of 2016, I was trying to figure out how I was going to kill myself sober. And, I mean, tell me how that has anything to do with a drink. I hadn't had a drink in 6 months, and I had obsessed for a month, you know, and I think like the one selfless thought that I had was knowing what suicide does to your loved ones from experiencing it. My aunt was like a second mom to us. She was one of us, and, you know, she took her life, and it's still painful. I think it gets harder as time goes on, to be honest, because the more good things that come into my life, the more I wish she was here to see. And it's really hard not having her around. I don't think it gets easier. And I know what that does, and that's the one thing. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm praying for a car to like crash into me on the way home from work. I'm going to say, like, in 2011 was the first time that I went to rehab. Well, the first time I went to inpatient rehab, like, I had tried the IOPs and the partial PHP. First time I went to like, a treatment center. And I was probably 50 pounds lighter than I am now. My face was sunken in. I wasn't showering. I wasn't changing my clothes. I wasn't brushing my teeth. I had no job. I had nothing to show for. I looked like a shell of a human being. That was in 2011. In 2016, when I said, like, I was at my, like, complete, like, most desperate place in my life, I had a job. I was showering every day, brushing my teeth every day, taking care of my son. I looked like I was okay. I was paying my bills. Like, there was time I couldn't even open a bill. I was so afraid of what it looked like inside. And I was doing all the things that you were supposed to be doing, according to society, we'll say. And I was dying on the inside. And I really do try not to judge people for how they look when they come in these rooms. Because some of the most well-put-together people could be completely dying on the inside. And some people that look like they're just done might not be. And it's not for us to judge when they are. It's, you know, I had to be broken inside. It's the outside is it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter we walk in with two black eyes and one shoe or whatever. That doesn't mean we're broken on the inside. And I think that's what I needed. It was like, you know, that crack in my spirit that opened my ears up and gave me that little bit of willingness to take some kind of action. And I remember I was on the third floor of my mom's bedroom in her house, and I was curled up in a fetal position on the bed, crying, trying to figure out what I was going to do to get out of this life. And that woman that I was judging about talking about God came to mind, and I reached out to her, and she started talking to me about alcoholism. She was armed with the facts, and my life has completely, like, that was a turning point in my entire life. Like, it's like we get to experience a whole new life in these rooms when we go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in these rooms and did no work, and nothing changed. If anything, I got worse because I was without my solution, which was alcohol, and I didn't have any kind of spiritual solution because I wasn't doing any work. And the pain got great enough, and thank God that it did, because, you know, I started showing up, and my life started to change. And day by day, I wanted to die a little bit less. It didn't happen overnight. I started showing up. You know, we were talking about AA. I was like, I hate AA. You know, I said, who we see here, what is said here, stays here. That, like that's a lie. People went back and told my brother what I shared. When I was at a meeting, and she was like, it's okay. Like, not everybody is well in AA. And that doesn't, you know, you can't pinpoint the whole entire program, you know, according to, like, what one person might have done. And so I remember, like, I didn't have a single number in AA in my phone. I had that resentment. I was breaking speaker CDs in my car and throwing them in the trash, the car wash. I just had this woman at this point, and I was like, just tell me what I have to do. And so I actually met her that day, and we started going through the steps. My son was, he was 4 years old at the time, turning five. And I would bring him with me. I would find babysitters. I would do whatever I had to do to show up and keep moving. I started going through the steps, and I was sponsoring other women within 60 days. I had, you know, like this conception of God that I grew up with. It's the Catholic God, and, you know, he's in the sky, and he's real far away, and he's always judging me, and he talks like Morgan Freeman, and I just, you know, that was the God that I knew. And I said, because she would talk about God in her heart. She's like, God, you know, God is in my heart. God is in my heart. I'm like, I don't feel that. Like, it feels like God is so far away. And she said, that's okay. Like, keep moving and keep doing the work. Your relationship with God is forever changing. It's going to change. It's going to grow. It's going to shift in ways that you're not even sure of yet. And so I just kept moving. I trusted her. And I remember, like, kneeling down to do the third step prayer with her, and I just started crying. I couldn't even say the prayer because I just, at that moment, like, felt a relief that I had never felt in my life. I started going to Fishtown Group because that's, like, where I'm from. That's my neighborhood. And I wasn't hiding anymore. And she said, you need to start going to neighborhood AA. There are people there that are going to need you, and that's where you're supposed to be. So I started to go, you know, my home group was on Thursday nights there. I showed up consistently. I started getting in service, taking meetings, you know, being a greeter. And I don't know. Like, I'm not going to say that right away I didn't want to kill myself anymore. But the obsession got a little bit less every time that I showed up. And at one point, I remember that I just felt like for the first time in my life, I was going to be okay and that I could breathe and just be who I am. And, like, just that alone, like, what AA has done for me, like, I can't even tell you. Like, feeling like I'm just so consumed with fear my whole entire life, always worried about who's judging me, who's talking about me, what people are going to think of me. You know, like, I have such low self-esteem, no self-worth, you know, in relationship after relationship of, you know, just men I shouldn't have been with because they would just make me feel worse about myself. And because that's what it was. It's like, I don't care, like, who they are to start. I'm going to mold them and fix them into who I need them to be. And that's, you know, that was a direct result of the way that I felt about myself. Like, I attracted those kind of people into my life. And so I, again, like, I just kept showing up. And I remember, like, how I talked about God being so far away. I had a woman speak for me one night. And she started talking about God in her pocket. Like, she would keep God in her pocket. And it was like, I don't know, like, how goofy that sounded. But I remember going home that night to pray. I got on my knees to pray. And I felt God right next to me. And it was like he went from all the way up in the, you know, the universe to, like, down right by my side. And that was, like, my first, like, shift in my relationship with God. And it's taken many forms. Like, I believe God is in people. Like, I believe that he's a light inside of all of us today. And that he's a light inside of me. And that if I'm not doing the work, if I'm not living in 10, 11, and 12, if I'm completely consumed with self, if I'm feared up about something that I'm not 10-stepping about, if I'm resentful, if I'm not really working a program, like, my light is going to dim. And if I'm helping others, if I'm showing up, if I'm doing the work, and I'm really moving my feet in this program, my light's going to shine brighter. And I think that's what it is, like, coming to these rooms and coming and, you know, to the home group or different meetings. No matter what, like, there's going to be someone lit up in these rooms. And, you know, it might be the guy with 3 days. It might be, you know, someone with 5 years. Like, time does not matter to me. We all have today. I know people with 30 years that struggle internally, and I'm not so sure I want what they have. And there are people with 30 days that I wish I had what they had. And I know that, like, I'm responsible for, you know, myself to grow. And as long as I remain teachable, I don't think we're ever done growing in these rooms. And so I talked about, like, you know, that shift that happened. And I remember, like, I had an experience. I was a woman who I, you know, was, like, in a relationship with, and she struggled. And I remember I was dying. Like, this was when I was, like, trying to figure it out. I was going to an old sponsor, and I was like, I need to go through the steps because I can't feel like this anymore. I'm going to die. And she was like, if you don't go through the book with someone that's on fire with it, you're not going to be either. And that kind of, like, set the tone for that journey for me. Like that woman that took me through the book. And she was my first, like, sponsor that actually took me through. I think I had, like, 3 or 4 other sponsors before that, but that was the first one that, like, took me through. And, you know, that woman wound up dying. And, you know, like, that was painful. That was like a really hard loss. And if it wasn't for the network that I had, if it wasn't for me going through the 12 steps before that happened, and, you know, men and women carrying me through those days, I don't think I would have gotten through it. And it's like, I've heard people say, go through the steps before you need them. Because life shows up, and I've experienced a lot of loss. I've experienced some tough times, but I've experienced, like, some of the most beautiful moments ever too. Like, I talked about, like, you know, constantly attracting, you know, not so great people into my life in relationships. And I took like 3 years to myself, like, you know, with God. Like, I did a lot of soul searching, like real digging. Like, they talk about in the 11th step, like, you know, seeking outside spiritual, you know, teachers and stuff. And I read books, and I, you know, I tried to read books before the 12 steps. I thought like conversations with God was the fix, or, you know, that was going to be the answer. And, I started picking those kinds of books up after I went through the 12 steps, and they really did like help me to grow spiritually. And, again, like I was single for 3 years, and then I remember I started talking to this guy, and I was almost like, again, like looking at all my friends. My friends are all, they're getting married. They're buying houses. They're, you know, having babies, and all these great things are happening for them. And I'm just like, am I going to be single forever? And it's like almost resorting back to that. I need this outside thing to fix what I'm feeling inside. And, so, I started to like force this relationship with this guy that, you know, it didn't feel great. But I wanted it to work because I just didn't want to be alone anymore. And so I went on like 2 dates with him, and then I remember going home and getting on my knees and crying. It's like this whole other third step experience I had again. Like, and I think I've had so many in different areas of my life. Like, I've had them with jobs. I've had them with relationships, like with alcohol, with life, whatever. Like, if I'm constantly turning situations over to God, that, you know, I shouldn't be in control of anything that goes on with me. And as long as God, if I'm going to Him, like, I know that I'm going to be okay. And if I'm, you know, it's like, God, you can have this part of my life, you can have this part of my life, but I got my relationship, I'm okay with this. I'll let you know if I need your help. And then it's like when I do that, the other areas tend to suffer. And so I was trying to force this relationship to work, and it just felt heavy. And I went home and I got on my knees and I started crying. And I was like, I remember saying, God, if you want me single for the rest of my life, I don't even care. Like, I just don't want to feel this way anymore. And again, it's just like bringing the steps into every area of my life. And that like relationship was done. And then my son, his barber, since he was 3 years old, had been getting sober. And me and him were just friends. Like, we were like truly just genuine friends. And, we wound up connecting on a different level, and we actually got married, in April, and are having a baby. So I get to experience like this whole new, like, even I remember getting on my knees, like, I don't know, maybe like 3 weeks ago, and praying and just feeling like a whole different sense of appreciation. Cause I like talked about my first pregnancy with my son and what that was. And like my life, I was just in such a different space in my life then. And then being able to, I never prayed when I was pregnant with my son. Like, unless it was, God, please don't let the cops search my car, or, you know, something of the sort to get me out of whatever situation I had put myself in. I didn't pray. And then like I was like praying, and I'm just like praying for a healthy pregnancy, and just thinking about it, and knowing that like having God in my life makes things a lot simpler. And I don't know, like, this is the first relationship, I'm 37 years old, this is the first healthy relationship I've ever been in my whole entire life. And it feels nice. And I have no doubt that it's because God is in the center of it. And I believe He was our matchmaker. If I had forced that relationship that I thought was gonna, you know, make me not single for the rest of my life, like, I would have missed out on all this that I have right now. And He's good to my son, and my son has a dad now, and he never got to experience that before. It was always just me and him. And I remember Benny was probably, I don't know, first grade, and he would just like, the one day he came home and he was just crying to me. And he was like, I'm never going to be able to meet my dad, am I? And I just had a talk with him and just said, like, you know, like, no matter what, we're going to be okay. And I really believe that God's going to put the most amazing man in our life one day. And he did. And it's like, if I had, and I know people say it all the time, but it's like, if I had only got what I wanted to get out of AA when I came here, I would have sold myself so short. And it's not, you know, all I wanted to do was just be sober and live normal. And I don't even know if I wanted to be sober. I probably just wanted to drink normal. But I wanted to at least not want to kill myself. And I don't know, like, it's not like hitting the Powerball. That would be pretty cool. But that's not like, you know, that's not what's going to fill me inside. And, you know, the perfect house, like, I have a Nissan, you know, it's not like this luxury car is going to fill me, this mansion is going to fill me, all the things I always thought, like, growing up, like, if I just made all the money in the world, I'm going to be okay. And it's none of those things. Like, I live paycheck to paycheck. I drive a Nissan. I live in a row home in Port Richmond. I like my life, though. I have peace in my life. My kid has peace in his life, my stepdaughter. Like, I am a good mom today. I show up for my kid, and, you know, some of the, like, coolest moments are, like, simply on the sideline at a soccer game and being able to, like, watch him score a goal and then run up and chest bump his friends like they just scored the winning goal in the World Cup. Like, 10-year-old kids, 11-year-old kids, just absolutely loving life. And they're a cool group. We really lucked out because he was on a team, like, he's been on a different team before, and I see other teams too, and it's like either the parents are crazy, the kids are bad, or the coaches are awful. And it's like, we really got it to where, like we had the whole triangle, and, you know, it just works well. And just like a little story, they have a 50-50 every year to raise money for their soccer team. Last year was $52,000. The winner got half. And so we did this wheel. Like, we had to do it legit. It had to be Facebook Live. Like, there's a bunch of money in this. So we had to make sure, like, everybody, and by the way, being an AA, like, one day not being able to get a day sober, stealing out of people's pocketbooks. Now I'm trusted with $52,000. Go figure. And so we do the wheel we all meet at one of the mom's houses. And we're spinning the wheel, and we had, like, you know, the grand prize winner, you know, we picked their name, and then we had, like, five, like, $100 winners just to, like, give more out. And then so it was done, and then my brother FaceTimes me from the firehouse. He's a Philadelphia fireman, and he FaceTimes me. He said, put all the boys' names on the wheel. The winner gets $100. So we put all our name on there, and then they're like, they're making sure everybody's on there. Is this person on there? Is this person on there? Me? I would have been like, no, don't worry about them. That's like one less for me to win. So they made sure everyone's on there, and then the wheel spins, and they're all going, go, go, go. They're chanting. They're jumping up and down, smiling, laughing, and then it lands on someone's name. They all cheer this kid on as if every single one of them just won. And so then they start chanting, $50, $50. So then they put up another $50 to parents. They spun it again. The next kid that won is a Spanish kid. He just moved over here from Spain. He can't speak a lick of English. And they just hear him chanting his name. They're like, Maddie, Maddie. And so he's over in the corner smiling. He has no idea what's going on, but he's like, has this biggest, like, bright light smile. And they're all cheering for him. And then they go over and they jump on top of him. And then they're $20, $20. So it goes down to $10. And, every single time, no matter who won, they all cheered. Like, they were just all so happy for the person that won. And it really brought me to tears. I wish I had videoed it because I'm like, that's what life should be about. I feel like AA gives us kind of that in a nutshell. It's like we're all just cheering each other on, and we want each other to win. And if we could only have that, like, childlike innocence about us back. And I know that so many of us have been through things that, like, completely instilled fear and insecurities and questionable, you know, anything with life. that it kind of blocks that. But I think God is the one that, you know, kind of frees us up to maybe be that again and have that, like, innocence about us again and that childlike love. That imagine if the whole entire world, like, just cheered each other on like that. And I don't know. Like, I think we would really be living in a different place. And I'm a daughter today. Like, I was a really crappy daughter for a long time. I used my parents. I would do the dishes because I knew my mom would throw me a $5 bill. And I, you know, stole from them when they stopped giving me money for doing the dishes. And, you know, brought them the tears. And I remember the one time when I was living in the Northeast in that apartment, and I wouldn't answer the phone. Like, if my mom called, I would not answer the phone because I had to wait to see if she left a voicemail, and I would check the tone of her voice on the voicemail to see if she was mad or not, or if she was just calling to say hi. And whether or not I would call her back was depending on how she sounded. And she hadn't heard from me in probably a couple of days, and she came up to the apartment and was banging on the window because she thought I had killed myself. And I call her every single day on the way to work just to say hi. And I get to talk to my mom every single day just to see how her day is going or tell her to have a good day. Those are like the living amends that I get to make. I remember, you know, my dad, they would go on vacation or whatever, trust me with the Powerball money, you know, to buy them, not anything crazy, but $20 here, play my Powerball tickets. And I would pocket the 20 and pray that the Powerball didn't hit. And, like, you know, getting $20 to fill the gas tank up and only putting 5 in and just constantly doing sneaky stuff and just being able to show up and be a family member today. I am godmother to 3 of my nephews and I am a good sister today and I'm a good friend and I'm a good mom. And I can really say that. And being a mom is not easy. Like, I'm not saying I'm proud of all the things that I, like, say sometimes to my kid. Because sometimes being a mom is really hard. Or a dad or, you know, just a parent in general. Because they don't listen all the time. And it's like, you know, I'm trying to... Then I'm worried, like, my son is going to be alcoholic. And I'm constantly, like... You know, checking out all his little behaviors and I'm telling him, stop being a follower when he's following the kids he shouldn't be following or trying to impress the kids that, you know, I think he shouldn't be impressing. And then I'm in the same breath telling him not to be a follower. I'm telling him, be more like this kid. And that's what it's like, this constant like control, because I think that if I, you know, control his every move and like what he's supposed to be doing, that I'm going to somehow beat him of coming down this path. And at the end of the day, like, that's not how it works. And I really do have to give him to God just as much as I give anything else in my life to God for it to be successful. Or for him to have a chance. I do know that he has a better chance with me as a sober mom than if I was still out there. And, but it's hard. Like, I remember there one time someone came to our home group to speak and he's like, I used to bite my nails from the time I was a little kid all the way up until I got sober, you know, a couple years ago. And then I'm like, oh my God, Benny bites his nails. And then for the next 5 minutes, I'm sitting there just thinking about how my son is an alcoholic, not listening to the speaker at all, which some of you might be doing right now. But it's hot, like just that constant trying to get out of self. Like I have a new sponsor today who has just, you know, really help me as far as trying to stay free. Because I could get so jammed up some days. If I'm not meditating, if I'm not praying, if I'm not helping others, like I tend to get a little more jammed up quicker. And I'm so grateful for this program. I am so grateful for the 12 steps. I know in my heart that there's no shot I would be here today had it not been for someone taking me through the steps and teaching me how to live and explaining to me that a drink has nothing to do with my real problem. And a drink is my solution to what I feel and the way my head and heart operate. And there's a better solution in these rooms. And I really am. Like, I owe AA my life for what it is today. And I don't know. I hope my message helped at least one person here. If not, I hope it planted a seed for a day later to come. And thank you all for having me. That's all I have.